Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Brazilian biologist Juliana Machado Ferreira. We'll talk about the illegal wildlife trade in Brazil and her research into the genetics of four bird species as she tries to help track down the origin of illegally captured birds that are highly sought after for the domestic pet trade. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is the sound of a Brazilian songbird that is a member of the cardinal family and can be found in the semi-open habitats of Eastern and Central South America. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Juliana Machado Ferreira on the illegal wildlife trade in Brazil. We'll focus on the domestic market for pet birds and what role wildlife forensic research can play in helping to expose and stop this trade. Juliana is a passionate Brazilian biologist who seeks to save the world one bird at a time. She is a TED Senior Fellow and is pursuing her doctorate in conservation genetics at the Laboratory of Evolutionary Biology and Vertebrate Conservation at Sao Paulo University. Her current research project involves developing species-specific molecular markers and population genetic studies of four bird species, with the aim to understand the distribution of their genetic variability and to track down the origin of birds seized from illegal trade. She works closely with the U.S. National Fish and Wildlife Forensics Laboratory, and her ultimate goal is to help set up a wildlife forensics laboratory in Brazil. When we spoke recently, I asked her how she first got interested in illegal trade of wildlife in Brazil.
I guess I liked biology and I liked basic research, but I wanted something more practical, more applied to reality. And then one of my professors introduced me to this guy who runs an NGO called SOS Fauna. And I began learning about the illegal wildlife trade in Brazil. And at the same time, I came across the National Fish and Wildlife Forensics Laboratory.
And that's in the United States, the National Fish and Wildlife Service Forensics.
Yes. And then I began learning that there was something called wildlife forensics, and I fell in love with it. And so it was kind of parallel. That's a difficult word for me. So I started to learn about wildlife forensics, and at the same time I started to learn about the illegal wildlife trade in Brazil, which is much bigger than average people, lay people imagine, and that I imagined. And then I just had to work with it. And I think I have a little bit of a police officer blood or something like that.
You like kicking down doors. We'll get into that.
I love kicking down. Yeah. Yeah.
So tell me more about the illegal trade of wildlife in Brazil. You know, what types of trade are there? What types of animals are involved?
There are many kinds of illegal wildlife trade in Brazil. We can kind of divide them in subcategories.
What are those categories?
There is the biopiracy, which aims to supply the biomedical research and pharmaceutical companies.
What kind of animals are involved?
This trade aims more at insects and poisonous animals and snakes and all the substances that can act as medicines. And
so like snake venoms or spider
yes,
venoms.
Yes, and plants. And this illegal trade also is very wicked because it also exploits the traditional knowledge of the forest people. So people disguised as researchers come into the forest, they learn how to use a plant to take care of a disease. They take this plant legally abroad to some company and lab and they study it. They isolate the active principle. Sometimes they're able to synthesize it in a lab. They make a pill and then they come here and sell it to us at a very high price, and we still have to pay royalties. So there is... Go ahead.
I was going to say, so that you said involves mostly, or a lot of insects and plants and medicinal.
Yes.
Things.
Yes. Also frogs, little frogs that are poisonous. All these little animals, insects, amphibians, plants that have an interesting active principle of being a poison or something like that. There is a legal trade to supply the biomedical companies, the biomedical research, which aims most at primates. It was worse in the 70s, but now it's more controlled, and it aims mostly at primates like monkeys from the genus Cebus. I don't know how you say that in English. The illegal trade to supply private collectors and zoos aims most at very rare, usually threatened animals, like blue macaws, and it's mostly international. The illegal trade of products, wildlife, and products trade, like love charms, luck charms, religious charms, and also head ornaments.
Tell me more about that.
This products trade aims at bones, eyes, legs, skin, fur, everything that people can believe it's aphrodisiac or may cure them from a disease, or may bring them luck, or even souvenirs that Europeans and Americans come here and they buy little paws of animals or skins. So it's all dead animals and products which are sold. And finally, there is the illegal pet trade, which is happens internationally. There are animals which are illegally traded to Asia, Europe, and United States, but the domestic illegal pet trade, it's so big, it's so important, it's major because it takes hundreds of and thousands of animals every month, and these animals are transported to be sold in big cities where the market is, and it's major, it's very serious, and people have no idea it happens. So that's my line of work.
Well, I think that's really interesting because most of the time when you think of the illegal pet trade or the pet trade, you think of selling, you know, parrots overseas from Brazil to Europe and to the United States and other countries. So tell me more about this domestic pet trade. What types of animals are involved?
What happens?
And are they usually alive? And because they're pets, they're usually alive. Is that right?
Yeah. It's a very strong cultural habit in Brazil to own wild animals. And people have no idea about the distinction between a wild species and a domesticated species. They think that if the animal is alive in a cage, it is a domestic animal, and that's wrong. The illegal pet trade in Brazil aims at small mammals like monkeys, maybe some sloths, reptiles, lizards, snakes, but 85 to 90% of the animals illegally traded are parrots and little songbirds, which are kept in cages.
So tell me more about what happens.
So what happens is they are taken mainly from the northeast, north and center west of Brazil. They are put in boxes, in very tight, dirty, hot little boxes, and they are transported by the thousands mainly to the southeast, where they are sold mainly in Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo, in small fairs, to people that think it's cool to own parrots and little birds in cages.
Are the animals kept in good conditions?
Most of the times, these animals are kept under horrible conditions. They are not fed properly. They are not clean. Obviously, they are not flying, so their muscles get atrophied?
Right, atrophied, yeah.
Yeah, and parrots tend to live longer, but birds, they do not live that long, so the market's constantly buying. And because grandparents teach kids that how to take care of the little bird, then kids want to buy the bird, so it's an ever-growing market. It's just growing and growing.
How big is the market?
If you imagine that only in São Paulo, in the big São Paulo, not only São Paulo City, but São Paulo and its outskirts, we have around 20 million people. If you think that half of those people, 10 million people, want to have 5 birds in their homes, that's 100 million. That's a bunch of animals.
as far as the songbirds are concerned, what kind of songbirds are involved in this? Is it anything at all, or is it targeting certain species?
There are some species that are always in the most traded and most seized lists, but it really depends. People like birds because they sing beautiful. People like birds because they look beautiful. So I can, for example, I work with flora bird species, and they are always in the list of most traded and most seized.
What are they?
They are the ultramarine grosbeak, Cyanolochsa brissoni.
So just so listeners have a sense of what we're talking about, this bird is a member of the cardinal family, and it can be found in the semi-open habitats of eastern and central South America. In Brazil, you can find the ultramarine grosbeak in the south, southeastern, and center-west parts of the country. Its shape looks similar to the cardinals we have here in Vermont, but the male has this intense blue color with darker colors on the ends of its wings and a blackish-gray beak and black legs. The female is brown, however. The species measures about 16 centimeters, and while nobody knows how many there are, scientists don't consider it a vulnerable species. So tell me about the second species that you're looking at. What's it called?
Okay. The buffy-fronted seed-eater, which is Sporophila frontalis.
So again, so listeners can picture this bird in their mind. The buffy-fronted seed-eater is considered a vulnerable species, and it can be found in southeast Brazil. Its populations have been declining rapidly due to trapping and deforestation. And it's dependent on bamboo, which makes it even more vulnerable. This one's about 13 centimeters long and has a stout yellowish bill. The plumage of the males contains various olive shades around its body, with grayer heads, a whitish buff forecrown, and a narrow streak behind the eye. It has a yellowish buff belly center and two buffy wing bars and a patch at the base of its primary wings. And the female is sort of browner with no head markings and reduced wing markings. So tell me about the third species that you're looking at. What's this one?
The green-winged saltator, Saltator similis.
The term saltator is Latin for leaper or dancer, and it describes the heavy way that these birds hop on the ground. This bird has a large range and is not considered vulnerable. The green-winged saltator is a secretive and hard-to-observe bird that's generally encountered in humid forests where they sort of skulk among the vegetation. They're a gray-green color with a white stripe above its eye, a cream-colored chest, and delicately greenish-yellow tinged wings. So what's the fourth or last one that you're looking at?
The red-collared cardinal, which is Parvaria dominicana.
This species is endemic to Brazil, and it's heavily exploited for the bird trade. The red-collared cardinal has a conspicuous bright red head, a white chest, and a collar, and it also has this mottled black, gray-black on the back and its wings with this striking white edging on the wings. So tell me about the laws in Brazil, especially vis-a-vis the bird trade.
In Brazil, we have not such good laws, but we have laws concerning the trade of Brazilian species. Non-native species can be traded as people like, which I think it's absurd because we never know if they're legal or not. But our laws only covers a native species.
Okay. So regarding native species of birds, what is the law?
Okay, the law is that some species, there is a list, can be bred in captivity, and the ones bred in captivity can be sold to people. Obviously, they must be registered and have papers and IDs and like bands, but it's very, very, so at all the other native species, you cannot trade, you cannot sell, you cannot own. But it's very easy to make an illegal bird look legal. It's very easy. We call them a bird washing machine. It's very easy to wash them.
So it's very easy to turn an illegal animal into what looks like a legal one.
It's very difficult to prove that it's illegal.
Is there a way to prove that it's illegal?
The forensic experts with the police, they can analyze the leg bands and analyze the documents. Sometimes if we trace the number that they give us, we see that this number was given to a bird which should be like 20 years old and there's no way it's alive. Mm-hmm. So yeah, sometimes the leg bands are really not well done. I mean, just by looking, I can tell they're fake, but people have to prove it. But at the same time, this is not our biggest problem.
What is the biggest problem?
Our biggest problem is the illegal trade, and people don't even try to make them look legal because it's so big and so difficult to seize and to find that they don't even try. It's just everything's illegal.
Why is that?
Because people see little birds as like minor crime. They don't see owning birds as a crime, as an offense. And our law says that owning or transporting an animal without a permit, we don't really talk about illegal trafficking.
Can you give me an example?
We have the owner in custody at the police. Everything, the only thing that happens is that this person is going to sign a document saying that they did this and it's wrong, and they may have to buy some food or perform some community work, but they usually don't. In theory, if we catch them again with illegal animals, they should go to jail, but they never do. Because even some policemen see this as a minor offense, a minor felony. Everyone has a friend or father who owns birds. Many police people own birds, so it's just not regarded as serious. People have no idea about the consequences of withdrawing so many animals from nature.
Wow. And is there an idea of how many animals are in fact withdrawn from their native, you know?
There are some stimatives. It's very difficult because the civil police has one, the environmental police has another, the federal police has another, the IBAMA, which is our Fish and Wildlife Services, has another. There is one stimative which tried to put all of those together. It's from an NGO called Henktas, which is a net against illegal wildlife trade in Brazil.
So you're referring to Henktas, which is a Brazilian nonprofit NGO that's aimed at combating the trafficking in wild animals. And it's headquartered in Brasilia, Brazil's capital city. And the website for that is www.renctas.org.br. And in 2001, they put together the first national report on wild animal trafficking in Brazil, which is the most comprehensive study on that theme. So what did they find?
They estimated that altogether, biopiracy, pet trade, wildlife products, collectors, zoos, biomedical research, altogether, all the crimes against wildlife in Brazil withdraw every year around 38 million animals from nature in Brazil.
38 million animals a year.
Yeah, but it's very difficult to estimate this because we have no idea. But if we, with my experience, I have been working in this field for some years now, I do not think this is overestimated. I think this is a good estimate.
So tell me about your work. Tell me specifically about what you're doing.
I have three lines of work, I guess, right now. One of them is with the NGO SOS Fauna.
What do you do for SOS Fauna?
I help them in seizures. We help the police in seizures because we have to identify which animals are legal, which animals are not, which species, is it a hybrid or not, because our legislation do not cover hybrids. So we go with the police in seizures, we identify the animals, and we provide the first aid, and then we either take the animals back to our NGO and rehabilitate them, or we send the animals to wherever the police or the IBAMA tell us, to other rehabilitation centers. And I really like this operation because I like to be with the police and to get to know the problem in depth. And that's how I got the nickname the policeman used with me. It's a Dr. Foot on the Door. Because one day we had to break in a house and they asked me if I wanted to kick the door down. And I said, sure.
So tell me how one of these operations work. Is it all in Sao Paulo? Or tell me how it starts. You get a call from either the NGO or the police?
We work mainly with Sao Paulo civil police, but there are seizures performed by the IBAMA and by the federal police in other states. But my work involves mainly Sao Paulo civil police. And we also have a very good contact with the highway Federal Patrol from Bahia. And we try to work with intelligence actions. So many times the seizures of other kinds of police are just because someone called them and said that their neighbors have a bird or something. We try to work with the dealers that we caught previously. We try to look in their notebooks. We try to find phone numbers. So there's this whole investigation going on. And then we end up knowing either when the cargoes are coming in, or we know some of the fairs where the animals are sold, and then we are able to find the deposits. So usually the NGO or the policeman call me and we set up this operation. Usually not many people can know about it, because when too many people know about it, usually we don't get anything because people tip people off. And then we just meet with the police at the police station, and we go either to the fairs and...
And the fair is like a big market where lots of things are being sold?
Yes, imagine a street fair where you have food being sold, vegetables, fruits, little home appliances, and then suddenly you see a bunch of people all together. This is always in the outskirts of the city. And then you see they have these little wooden boxes, and they have bunches and tons of birds in there. And they all have backpacks, and when you open their backpacks, they're full of animals. So in the fairs, usually the police officers have to close all the streets around it, and then we run inside, and then people run, and the police officers just catch the people and throw them on the ground and cuff them. So it's more action. Or we just go in the houses and the deposits, and we get in and we find the animals or not, and someone responsible has to go to the police station with us.
I was going to say, so then what happens?
And then at the police station, while the policemen question the people involved, we take care of the animals. We provide them first aid, electrical lights. I can't say this word. Just vitamins and food and fruits and clean cage. And we sort the animals out. And then we have to decide where they are going.
When you get them in this, when they're confiscated like that, are they in good condition, or are they, you know, needing a lot of
medical? Most of the times they're in horrible conditions. When we catch them at the fairs, they are usually pretty hurt. They have open wounds. Their beaks are hurt because they're just going against the cages. Many times the legs are broken, the wings are broken, or the wings are cut and they cannot fly. They are usually dehydrated, hungry, sick. When we seize them from people's houses, it really depends. Most of the times the cages are filthy. They're not being fed the correct food. They are usually very thin. Their feathers are all destroyed. Their beaks are hurt. But some homes, sometimes we find animals a little bit better cared for. Even though their muscles are atrophied and they have no... They cannot fly. They have to be thought again how to recognize the foods they fight in nature, because they're all fed with the industrialized food. So the picture is bad. It's heartbreaking.
And how many birds, when you say when you raid a fair like that, how many birds do you end up confiscating right then?
It really depends. When we're talking about cargoes, the shipments, the big trucks that the highway patrol usually intercepts, we talk about cargoes of 3,000 animals. Okay? Mm-hmm. Around 1,000, 3,000. Obviously, they can be transported in smaller cargoes and it's more difficult to seize them, but there are dealers that we know about that transport 3,000 animals every 40 days, and it's just so many. It's scary. The fairs, we usually talk about in a two-hour raid. In one fair, little one street fair, we usually talk about 200 to 600 animals. Wow. And homes, it really depends. The range is from 1 to 2 birds to 200 animals from each house.
And then what happens after you give them sort of emergency care?
They are going to be sent to either governmental triage facilities, which sometimes the conditions are horrible as well, or they're going to be sent straight to rehabilitation facilities. There are many here in São Paulo. And in these rehabilitation facilities, they're going to learn how to fly again. They're going to exercise their muscles. They're going to be properly fed. They're going to be cared for concerning veterinary care, parasites. They're going to be all cared for. And then the problem is, once these animals are rehabilitated, what do we do with them?
Which was going next question. So what do you do with them? Do you even know where they came from?
That's a big problem. Many times, with some questioning police intelligence work, we can infer their origins, but many times we have no idea where they came from. And we cannot just send them back anywhere, because we could be inserting in the population which is receiving these animals new strains of bacteria, diseases. And if these animals come from the same species but from distinct populations in terms of genetics, if we mix them, we may have a problem concerning the genetics. So we may make this population even weaker. If we just release them anywhere, we may be doing more harm than good, both to the released animals and to the natural populations.
So what does that mean exactly?
So it's very important to infer the correct origins so we can just send them back as close as possible to their true origins.
Which actually gets into some of your work on your PhD. I know you're working on the genetic origins of various species of songbirds, which are very involved in the illegal trade in Brazil. Can you tell me more about your research?
Yeah, that's my other line of work, my PhD project, which I'm developing in the Laboratory of Evolutionary Biology and Vertebrate Conservation in University of São Paulo. And my advisor is Professor João Morganti. And my co-advisor is Dr. Mary Curtis from the Wildlife Forensics Lab, United States.
What exactly is your research on?
What I'm doing is I'm working with those little four bird species I told you before. And I am developing molecular markers so I know where in the DNA it's interesting for me to look at. Because the DNA is very big, right? It's like 3 billion base pairs, whatever. So sometimes we are not sure where in the DNA it's interesting to look at. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm just finding informative pieces of the DNA of these four species.
Then what will happen? Why do you need that?
Once I get those, I'm going to perform a population genetic species, meaning that inside each species, I'm going to try to see if I have different genetic populations. For example, if I have a cardinal which occurs in the state of Pernambuco and also in the state of Bahia, my question is, are those different populations in terms of DNA or not? Because they can be the same species and still be different.
So if they are different, then what?
If I find different populations inside each species, what I want to do is analyze the animals seized in São Paulo and then with DNA try to infer at least the region where they were taken from, and then try to use the information with the police intelligence and investigation, and then we can really narrow down where the animals probably came from.
What would that mean for the animals?
So we can both send them back to the correct place, but also we can infer, the police can infer most exploited regions, most probable routes used by the dealers. And it's just another source of information. And then, with this, I come to my third line of work, which I've been studying wildlife forensics since 2005. I've been working in collaboration with the Wildlife Forensics Lab in the United States. And I want to help the federal police is already doing this in Brazil, but I want to help the establishment of a true and serious wildlife forensics in Brazil. Either in the police lab, either in an independent lab, I just want to help to make wildlife forensics in Brazil actually work, and we can actually use scientific data in the legal process to try to help prosecute or not, but help the legal process in crimes concerning wildlife.
Currently, only the United States has a dedicated wildlife forensic lab, which is part of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and it's located out in Ashland, Oregon, and that's the lab that you work with. And some states have wildlife forensics labs attached to them as well. Internationally, there are a few other countries who do have some wildlife forensics attached to various parts of either the government or in the states or at universities.
So going back for a minute to your DNA research, talking about the molecular markers. So the DNA has, you said, three billion strands or 3 billion base pairs. And so you need to find within those 3 billion, what is unique about this species over another species?
No, I'm not comparing species. I'm comparing populations within species.
So tell me about the difference then of what you're looking for genetically.
I'm working with four species because I wanted more data and more results, but you can imagine each species as a separate project.
Okay, so you're essentially doing four projects, four separate projects.
Yeah, kind of.
So your first situation is finding out what markers to use or what's parts of that DNA to look at.
It's because we have many different places in the DNA. There are the codifying genes, which are conserved.
And when you say conserved, what you mean is that that gene is maintained or the same, essentially the same, over evolution or over the species. So what other types of genes are there?
There are genes in the mitochondria, which tell me more about the matrilineal, the female history. There are genes which we think they are neutral, so they are less conserved. So there are many different pieces in the DNA, and they will answer different questions.
Can you give me an example or tell me what you mean by that?
So if I want to compare different species, I'm going to try to find something more conserved because the species, they diverged so long ago. But if I want to compare populations within species, They are so hard to find inside the DNA pieces which are less conserved. They are more polymorphic. They are more variable. So that I have variability to compare. Does it make sense to you?
So you want to find certain things that will vary, whereas if you were looking at the species identifying genes, you would want something that's very conserved or stays the same across all members of the species. So you want...
Exactly, yeah.
So you're trying to find the thing that varies somewhat depending on where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And have you found those markers? Have you found different characters that do vary across...
I'm in the middle of the process. I did find some highly variable regions called microsatellites. So now what I'm doing is I'm comparing each of these, what we call loci, each of these places in the DNA, I'm comparing within each species. And now... this is what I'm doing right now. I'm trying to figure out if they are variable or not. So this is just where I am right now.
Aha. Uh-huh. And you might very well have found it on one of the species versus another one.
Exactly, yeah. That's why I chose four, because I wanted to make sure I had results. Maybe I don't have in one, but I have in another, so.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the birds that you're looking at? Are they all songbirds? And are they big, little?
They're small birds. They're little. The cardinal and the saltator are a little bit bigger. The saltator and the grosbeak are beautiful, and they sing beautifully as well.
Can you sing their song?
No, I cannot sing their song. I can sing the seed eater song, which I have no idea why people love them so much, because all they do is a choo-choo-choo, choo-choo-choo. choo-choo-choo, and it's just so heartbreaking to look at that little bird alone in a cage. I have no idea why they like the seed eater so much. It's a little, very little brown bird, and it just does choo-choo-choo. It doesn't really sing. And the cardinal is just really beautiful. It's not really a songbird, but it has this bright red head and this white chest and these black wings. And also it's I think it's a cultural phenomenon. It's very, very interesting because the cardinal occurs in the Brazilian desert, which is called the Caatinga, which is in the northeast of Brazil. And many people here in São Paulo who northeast like these birds because it reminds them from where they came from. So they bring these animals all the way, they buy them, and they want to keep them here to remind them of their childhood or of their homeland. So it's I don't know, I don't know if it's psychological or sociological. It's a weird phenomenon.
And then how do you even collect the DNA from these birds?
There are two sources of DNA. Some animals, some biologists collect the whole specimen, meaning they just kill the bird and they put them in the museum, which is very important because we need vouchers in the museum to be able to analyze, you know, the skeleton and the feathers. But what I do is I collect a couple of drops of blood from their wing, which is good because it keeps them alive. But it's bad because it gives me very little sample. So sometimes I run out of sample and I don't have any left.
Okay. And so how do you even catch the birds to collect?
Animals is easy. Yeah, because okay. They're in cages, right?
Okay.
But the animals from nature, people who collect the specimens, which I had to do a couple of times and I hated, but it's important, use usually small air pressure guns. Mm-hmm. But I just did that a couple of times because I really needed it, and this is a different discussion. But what I do usually is I set up mist nets. They're huge nets, like fishing nets, and they're very thin and the animals don't really see it. We set up them somewhere in the bird's territory, and usually we look at the bird and we see them flying and we kind of understand the patterns that they use, some ways in between the vegetation. And we open the net. We try to open the net in a place where we think the bird's going to patrol the territory using this path. And we play the song. We use a playback technique. So we play the song of another bird of the same species using an iPod or whatever. And the bird wants to defend its territory, so it gets attracted and starts to patrol the territory around the song.
Huh.
He thinks that there's another bird invading its territory. And then when it's just patrolling and trying to defend its territory, it falls in the net. It gets all tangled. That's why you have to be very trained and skilled to work with mist nets, because it's very easy to hurt an animal. You have to be very careful when taking the animal out of the net. You need lots of training and you need a license. You need a license even to buy a mist net. So you take the animal from the net, and then it's very easy. I just clean the vein in the wing. Just make a little very small punch with a very small needle. Take a couple of drops of blood. Medicate the wound. I put anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial drug it's very tiny, you can even see it. And I give the bird something to drink. It's kind of a Gatorade to birds. And I wait the bird to be all nice and well. And then we measure the bird. And once we are sure the bird's in a good shape, we just release them. And also we leg bend them. We put a little ring in its legs so we can identify it.
Is storing the samples an issue? Where are you when you're doing this? You're out in the bush or you're near the...
Yeah, usually we're out in the bush. Field work is beautiful, but it's very tiring. We have to carry all the material and walk a long way, and there are bugs, and it's cold, and it's raining, and it's so hot. But anyways, it is not an issue because nowadays I can store the blood in ethanol. so I don't have to really freeze it. I don't need a refrigerator. The problem is that the ethanol has other problems. It makes my sample very dry, so it's not so easy to extract DNA afterwards. But with today's techniques, I mean, it would be better to have fresh blood, but it's not a problem at all. And it's good because I don't need to have a refrigerator all the time, because this is just not, you know, where we go to do field work is just away from everything. So there's no way I'm going to have a refrigerator.
Right. And then
people tell me, why don't you take a gallon of liquid nitrogen? Like, okay, it's just me and another person in the middle of the bush. And you want me to carry liquid nitrogen? Come on.
And so tell me about some of the problems you've faced in doing your research. Because I think, you know, on TV, you see people and it looks so easy. Boom, boom, boom. You put something in a test tube and you have results. But in reality, it's not really like that, is it?
It's completely the opposite. First of all, you have to get your samples. And then you think, you know, people from the United States ask me why our rangers don't send us the samples. I'm like, okay, we don't have rangers. And if we did, they don't know how to catch a bird and they don't know how to take samples, you know. I mean, it's just so different. We have to go to the bush. There are laboratories which have this. They always go in expeditions. They have money. They are able to take big groups. This is not my case, so I had money to go, me and another researcher, just two people. We had to find a place and we had to go in the bush in the middle of nowhere. And many times these places are dangerous. You don't want to just walk in the woods, you know, two people from the southeast. So we usually don't have that many resources. We have to fly to a place. We have to make the local contacts, we have to find a place, we have to find the animals, we have to go to a place where we know we're not going to get robbed or killed or anything. And then we collect the samples, we come all the way back, and then if you watch CSI, you think you're going to put your sample in a centrifuge and your printer is going to give you all this. Sometimes the materials you have don't work, sometimes the equipment you have don't work. In Brazil, sometimes we have to wait for months to get an equipment through. Just sometimes things don't work, equipment don't work, so it can be difficult. For example, right now I'm using a technique which is, I don't know, 25 years old, and in the laboratory in the United States there is a state-of-the-art machine which I could do the work of a year in 2 months, I don't know. So it's difficult, it's not that easy to do research. Of course there are exceptions, there are labs that have all sorts of fancy machines, but they're not very good about sharing. So.
And are the results, does it just take longer, or do the results differ so that perhaps, say, older equipment, you can't extract the DNA, but in newer equipment, you can?
Well, sometimes if you're using a gel to try to understand if you have one band or two bands in your sample, that meaning if you have a polymorphic sample, sometimes you cannot tell because the how to say scale. I don't think that the results would differ. I think it just takes longer, I guess. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have to make so many tests that my sample, I just run out of sample, and take me to do in the United States here, it takes me a month. For example, in the lab in Ashland, I could take a plate of samples, go to sequence. And here I have to wait, I don't know, 1 week and a half, 2 weeks, so that the only sequencer in our whole department is available so that I can sequence my samples, you know.
So you have to wait for some of the equipment, too, to even get started, because a lot of people are using it. So
and for example, it's funny. I have, for example, money to pay for a hotel or for gas or for food in the field, but I have very little money, for example, for plane tickets. So how do they expect me to get to places? If you remember that Brazil is a continental country, I cannot. It's, you know,
it's huge.
I need. Yeah. So they will give me money to feed and to stay in the field, but they will not give me money to arrive where I need to go. So it's funny.
So how do you address that?
We just try to make the best we can with what we had, with what we have, which also makes us very creative. And it's, I think it's easier for us to overcome problems because we have to overcome problems so often that we just know what to do when things don't work as they should. But for example, instead of making many trips to the Northeast, I make one or two huge, very long trips. So that's what I did in the beginning of the year. Instead of going to one location and then to another location from São Paulo, I just flew on my way there and I just drove, I don't know, 4,000 kilometers at a time with a car so I could get everywhere I needed to go. But I still need to go other places and I still have to figure out if I can, how I'm going to get to the places because I need more samples. It's funny because you don't have money to buy a plane ticket to get to the field. And then when people judge your work, they say you need more samples. And I'm like, yeah, how do you want me to get them?
So. What have been some of your biggest challenges in doing this work?
I think that the first one is that it's heartbreaking, both from the people's perspective and from the animals' perspectives.
What do you mean?
So when I go with the police, we do find criminals, but we also find people that just didn't know better. And they go to the police station, they cry, and it's very sad, and it's difficult to deal with people. Also, I was very lucky that my advisor helped me in this crazy project because I don't think other people would. My advisor is just very brave and courageous and he trusts us. He's not afraid of just signing a project which is uncertain and difficult. And so I was lucky to find my advisor. But I think that the most difficult thing was to get samples from the natural population, samples with known origin so that I could have my standards. And also using these old techniques, which take longer and much more work, and they're not so reliable, in a position of, I know there are better equipment that I could be using, and we don't have money for them. So, I mean, there is money, but people who have the money don't think it's important to buy them. So.
Right. And then what about the implications and potential impacts of your work? You were talking about what you hoped it would do regarding the domestic trade and in terms of rehabilitation. So if you do find distinct populations in these four species, what will happen to that? How can you use it?
I think that if I'm able to develop these protocols, the chances of the birds going back to nature just increase many times because we're going to have protocols which are ready to use. So next time that there is a seizure with this one of these species, we're going to be able to test them and try to infer their origins. I'm not saying that we're going to be able always because sometimes the DNA profile is not going to match what we have, but it's just another source of information. But mainly, more than that, I think that my work will help the establishment of wildlife forensics in Brazil. I'm not the only one doing this here. There are other researchers that think this is important. So I think we're going to start to create a group that is developing protocols and it's showing that it's possible and important. So we're bringing attention of the politics and of the decision makers to these issues. And hopefully they're going to invest more in the federal police crime lab. They're going to lawyers and prosecutors are going to start knowing that they can use this kind of information. So I think it's a major step here in Brazil.
Wow. So in addition, really, to helping the birds themselves go back to where they came from, you'll help in the prosecution of this, but you'll also help not just regarding these birds, but also establishing a forensic facility or just more knowledge that for wildlife forensics even exists.
Yes. It's not always that the scientific information is going to be useful, but I think, for example, if you have a bird that it's very widely distributed and you can infer its origin from, I don't know, the northeast of Bahia, then it's another information that it was an interstate crime, for example. So I think these informations will begin to be used, and We either are going to have a facility which is just focused on wildlife forensics, or the forensic experts from the federal police are going to, they have to get more attention, more funding. Hopefully they're going to be able to just work with wildlife forensics and not spend their time in other kinds of crime. So I really hope to show the decision makers and the politicians that it's possible and it's important and it's needed. So it's just one more step together with all the researchers and the federal police people and the forensic experts that are trying to do the same that I am. So
I wanted to close by asking, what else is needed and where could people go for more information if they became interested in these issues?
Of wildlife forensics, of illegal wildlife trade, of pet trade, of the issues?
Of all three of those issues, because really we talked about all three, wildlife forensics, the illegal pet
trade. And you're talking about information in English or in Portuguese?
both.
In Portuguese, I think that the IBAMA website is a good website. I don't have it in my head right now. I think it's www.ibama.gov.
That's right. It's www.ibama.gov.br for Brazil.
The federal police website may have something on forensics.
And that website is www.dpf, or Department of Police Federal.gov.br. And again, using Google, you can translate these pages fairly easily. And are there others?
I can give you the SOS Fauna website, which is www.sosfauna.org, which has a link in English. It's not perfect English. I don't know who did the translation, but you can find more information there.
Oh, fantastic.
And also concerning wildlife forensics, you can search Google for the National Fish and Wildlife Forensics Laboratory. It's a great website. There's lots of information, and I think everyone's going to enjoy it.
That is www.lab.fws.gov.
And then do you have any last comments about what we've talked about?
I just wanted to say, we did talk about our problems and our difficulties, but I just want to say that I'm here and I'm doing the work. So I have funding from the state government, and I have an advisor who accepted me and helps me and backed me up, and Dr. João Morganti, and SOS Fauna, and the civil police. So I'm very thankful, because even with all the difficulties, there are lots of people who think this work is important and who think this work's going to make a difference. So yes, there are difficulties, but there are amazing people who are trying to make a difference, and I wouldn't be here without them and the funding and my advisor. And so I think it's more positive than negative. So,
oh, that's a good way to end. I appreciate that. Well, thank you very much, Juliana.
Thank you. Thank you for being interested.
Oh, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Juliana Machado Ferreira on the illegal wildlife trade in Brazil and what role wildlife forensic research can play in helping to expose and stop this trade.
Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly.
This week's creature call is the sound of a Brazilian songbird that is one of the species studied by Juliana. It is the ultramarine grosbeak, which is a member of the cardinal family and can be found in the semi-open habitats of Eastern and Central South America. While the female is mostly brown, the male has an intense blue color with a gray-black beak and legs. Listen to the song of the ultramarine grosbeak. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.